Welcome to Giving an Answer, the show dedicated to defending the historic Christian faith. I am your host, H.C. Felder, and today the topic is answering objections to the resurrection. And I have a very special guest with me, Dr. Gary Habermas. Let me tell you about Dr. Habermas. He has a PhD from Michigan State University in History and Philosophy of Religion. He's currently the Distinguished Professor and Chair, Department of Philosophy and Theology at Liberty University.
Right.
He's author of 25 books, including The Risen Jesus and Future Hope, The Historical Jesus, Evidence for the Life of Christ, The Case for the Resurrection, which we're going to be talking about today. And he's published over 100 articles and reviews and has given over 1,000 lectures at almost 100 different colleges, universities, and seminaries in the U.S. and elsewhere. Welcome to the show, Dr. Habermas.
Thank you. I'm glad to be with you.
All right.
Good topic, too.
Yeah. So we're talking about your topic. This is your topic. You are the expert on the resurrection.
Well, it's not my I tell people God raised him from the dead. I just talk about it.
Okay. So what makes you so passionate about this issue?
Well, I think it started for sure because I went through a period of doubt myself. The main period was about 10 years. And then I went through some intermittent doubts for longer than that. And people would say to me, try this or try that, or why don't you look at this evidence, or have you checked this out, or have you checked that out? And you know, I was just really looking for like your program, giving an answer. I was looking for reasons to believe if there was anything. And I would even dialogue with Christians from time to time. I mean, it wasn't always a real kind dialogue. I was bugged that they couldn't push or come up with more things. And so anyway, because of that, I went from topic to topic to topic, and I would say, well, this topic's okay, but it's got these issues. All right, well, let's try this one. I hope, you know, it'd be nice if this one, no, it's got this. Well, so after trying topics, I settled on the resurrection, and I knew that if the resurrection was what the New Testament claimed it was, that we would have some good grounds for believing Christianity is true. But then I thought, yeah, but I mean, how do you know dead men rise?
Right.
You know? So for me, starting the resurrection was strictly an answer to my own questions. Then I realized the more I got into it, I've been on this topic nonstop now for 30 some years or more. I realized it can answer other people's questions, and it really is the best thing Christians have going. So that's kind of, I'll add one more thing. You could talk about other evidences, and you can be a mile away from the gospel. But when you talk about the resurrection, you are discussing the gospel. So it's defined in the New Testament, the gospel is a minimum, gospel data, at a minimum, would be the deity, death, resurrection of Jesus. Those three things. And so when you talk about the resurrection, you're not down the block, you're talking about the heart of Christianity. So for those two reasons, it met my needs and it's at the center. I think everything's grown from there.
You said that the resurrection is at the heart of Christianity. What do you mean? Why is the resurrection so important to Christianity?
Well, the way the gospel figures in the New Testament is there is a factual side and there's a belief side. Let me use the illustration of marriage. We would think a person wouldn't be very intelligent if they just, eeny, meeny, miny, moe, I'm going to marry you. There's a time that in the old days we'd call courting or something. Today we might call dating. But you get to know a person and you want to know facts about them. And you walk and you talk and hopefully you know that person better than anybody in the universe. But that's not the definition of marriage. That's getting to know somebody. Without the I do, you're not married. So there's a I know you side, and there's a I'm committed to you side. Without either one, for all intent and purposes, there's no marriage. And I think that's very analogous to Christianity. There's a content side. We're talking about a person named Jesus Christ, and I think there's good evidence that he was claiming to be the Son of God, claimed to be deity, was killed, went to death, was crucified, and was raised from the dead. So that's this dating period, let's say. You want to know who he is. You have questions. You're, you know, given an answer. And so that's the heart of the Christian message. The question is, is somebody ready to say I do, and under what conditions are they ready to say I do? And that's the faith side. That's the commitment side. So I guess my direct answer would be, you don't get into Christianity by saying, well, have you heard of this argument for God's existence? Well, I mean, that's really good. But I mean, I always remember the time that I saw a very nice full-color magazine of an Eastern religion. And when you open up the magazine, the first article was a PhD in physics giving a cosmological argument for God's existence. Just a reminder that other people can buy some of these arguments. Some of these are natural arguments, and some of these are special revelatory arguments. The resurrection kind of ties it all together for me.
Right, and one of the things you mentioned in your book, the case for the resurrection, is that Christianity hinges on the resurrection.
Absolutely.
I mean, if the resurrection did not happen, Christianity is false.
Absolutely. In the New Testament, the resurrection is tied to almost every major doctrine, almost every area of content, and almost every area of practice. So there are over 300 verses in the New Testament. I guess my point I'm getting at is, this isn't something I made up. This isn't a slogan that I'm saying. My point being that it all stands to the resurrection. I mean, Paul says it very clearly in 1 Corinthians 15, right. And he makes the point that, basically in a nutshell, with it we have everything, without it we have nothing. So if it all stands on that, and one of the verses says, verse 18, if Christ has not been raised, then our loved ones who've died in Christ have died in vain. You're talking serious territory here, especially for myself. My wife died in 1995 of stomach cancer, and I'm remarried, but she died in 1995. And resurrection to me is more than just, it's this body of facts. It's even more than saying I do. It's sort of like this, where does it lead down the road kind of question. What does it mean down here? So everything's tied to it.
Yeah, your book is the best book I know, the case for the resurrection on defending the resurrection. And your approach is so great. I mean, I use this all the time. I mean, I've worn my book out. What you call the minimal facts approach, 4+1. Could you explain briefly what that is?
Yeah, my co-author and I, Mike Lacone, a former student of mine, he's finishing his PhD right now, and he's also specializing in the resurrection, I'm glad to say. We developed an argument that says you can take the data that critical scholars are willing to admit. They don't have to be Christians. They can be liberals. They can be atheists. They can be anything you want. But people who write in this area, I'm not talking about the guy off the street who says, I'm not going to give you any of those facts, because you can talk to those folks too. But what this is based on is that scholars who specialize in historical Jesus studies, and in particular about that last weekend of Jesus' life, they know that some data are virtually unassailable. Some things are just, there's multiple evidences. So I came up with an argument that said, I will use only the arguments, only the facts, only the data that have two characteristics. One, they are multiply attested from a variety of reasons. One thing in history that you look for when you're asking how do we know something happened is if there are reasons that come in like this. And especially if it's an unexpected one or a backdoor reason, and here's some frontal, regular type historical, you know, normal historical arguments. But when you get a fact that is multiply evidenced, that's a really good sign. My second criterion, and it's not quite as important as this one, is that virtually every scholar concedes this. I don't care if he's an atheistic New Testament scholar. I don't care if he's a Bible-believing Christian. If he studied this, he grants these data. Now, the reason we call it 4+1 is because the proper list I use, and I've counted, and it's agreed to by probably 95 to 99% of scholars. But there's another fact that is only agreed to by perhaps 75% of scholars, 70-75. That's the empty tomb. I think the empty tomb is really important. It doesn't prove a risen Jesus, but it gives some more evidence in that direction. So that's the 4+1. The plus one is the empty tomb because it doesn't have quite the unanimous consent that these other facts do.
Now, what are the four facts?
Well, I use different, sometimes I use four, I use five, I use seven,
okay.
Because really my point is, most critics will give me 20. And they'll say, can you get there with 20? And I'll say, I think I can get there with a dozen. Matter of fact, I think I can get there with 4, 5, or 7. So my list kind of changes. But if I were going to use 4, besides that plus one being the empty tomb, I would use Jesus died by crucifixion. And this might sound strange to a lot of your listeners because they think I'm smuggling something in the back door. I'm not. Probably the most readily conceded fact in the life of Jesus is that his disciples believed he was raised from the dead. His disciples believed they saw him again. So he died. His followers thought he was raised from the dead. That's all I require. They thought he was.
Right.
And then I would take that proclamation was very, very early. We can the earliest gospel, somebody could say, well, look, the earliest gospel's not for 40 years. I'd say, but look, I will cite only critics who don't believe the Bible's inspired at all, and they believe we can get this message back to 30 AD. Approximately whatever date you say the cross is, just goes right back to there. So I'd say an early proclamation, and let's use the Apostle Paul. If I was going to use a fifth one, I'd put James. I like to use Paul and James because they are skeptics who come to Christianity because they believe they saw the risen Jesus.
Right.
So I would use that, tack that the empty tomb is the plus one, and that's the data. And notice, I don't ask any inspiration. I don't say, well, my friend, you've got to believe the Bible's inerrant to give me these facts. I don't assume any of that. And none of the things I ask people to concede, none of them are supernatural, not a single one.
Right. And that's what I love about your approach, and it's just summarize what you said, that there are basically 5 points, well, 4 plus 1 mm-hmm. points, that virtually all scholars agree on, whether they're atheistic,
right.
whether they're, you know, liberal,
they can be
whatever
atheists.
It is.
They
right.
can be agnostic.
Right. They
sure.
agree with the fact that Jesus died, that clearly the apostles believed that they saw him rise from the dead, I mean, because they wrote it, and they went to their grave, you know, professing it, and the conversion of Paul and the conversion of James and the empty tomb.
Yep.
So those are the first five, those are the 5 points, basically. Mm-hmm. Now, what I want to talk about now is because the show is called Answering Objections to the Resurrection. And the point that you make is that any theory that comes up to assault the theory of the resurrection mm-hmm. has to deal with those 5 points. So
right.
if these
few,
5 points.
Yeah, I throw in one or two others, but 4 to 7. Yeah, I'm even so bold as to make the claim that I believe I can deal with the major questions about the resurrection without even going beyond these facts.
Right.
Or when I say going beyond these facts, I mean the individual data that support each of those facts.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
I think we can answer the questions from this alone. So I don't have to say, well, Harold, man, that's a really tough question. I think if you allow that the Bible's inspired, I'll bring that one
right,
over here.
Right,
I don't make that move.
Right. And the good thing about what you do is that, which is very good to reach skeptics, is that you don't use the Bible as inspiration. You use it as a document, as any historical document.
Yeah, when I go to, now that doesn't mean, I mean, I believe the Bible is inspired.
Absolutely.
But
absolutely.
I don't use it here. No one has to concede. When I go to university campuses and lecture, frequently I will take that objection, it's a common objection, and I will use it right at the beginning so that skeptics there know I'm talking their language. And I'll say, you know, I'm told that this crowd is maybe 50-50, Christian and non-Christian. Some of you non-Christians right here, you want to know what the basis is, and you might start with your Christian friends, and your approach might be something like this. Your objection might be, you want me to believe in the man? Yeah. But the man's in the book. Yeah. But I don't believe the book, so
right.
I don't believe the man.
Right.
And so I'll tell the skeptics in the crowd, I'll say, look, the argument I'm going to give tonight, you don't have to grant, hold up a New Testament or something. I'll say, you don't have to grant that the New Testament's inerrant. You don't have to grant the New Testament's inspired. You do not even have to grant that the New Testament's trustworthy or reliable. It can be an untrustworthy ancient piece of literature.
Right.
It's right. at least that. It has to be, it has to go next to Homer and Shakespeare
right.
and some great works.
Right.
And some religious works.
Right.
But no matter what this is, I can get to these facts.
Yeah.
You go, well, yeah, but what about this problem with this text over here? Let's abide by the rules we both agreed to. I'm saying I think this data will take you to resurrection without assuming inspiration or anything. If you say, well, I believe in inspiration. Oh, okay, well, now we're on a different subject.
Right.
Or if the guy says, no, I won't give you any of your facts. That's a curious kind of response. Almost nobody does that. It's not the guys who study the data.
Right.
I deal with the best-known skeptics in this country. I've had dialogues with them in talks and written dialogues, and they almost never dispute the data.
Right.
So you talk about what the data mean.
Right. Right. So let's see how this works.
Sure.
An example. Now, like I said, these are five facts that pretty much are given. And so any theory that comes up against the resurrection has to deal with these five facts, okay? What about people who would say to you that the resurrection is just pagan legend that was stolen by the Christians, and they built this whole resurrection story around Osiris and Mithra and all these ancient legends?
Sure. Sure. And you know, I'll just do an aside here. I'll hype up the criticism even more strongly. I'll make it worse. I've got a friend. I actually met him here in Charlotte years ago. He surveys skeptical websites, and he said that of all the skeptical websites, probably 90% of them use that objection.
Yeah.
Probably 90%. But here's the disconnect, Harold. I'd ask you this. 90% of these websites say they stole it from other religions. But I'd say, how come these critics that I talk to, the guys who really know the subject, but they're agnostics or atheists, how come they don't use this argument?
Right.
Why a disconnect between the popular skeptical sites where 90% perhaps use this and the individual skeptics? So they may mention it. They might say, well, there's a little something over there, but they won't make this argument. Why don't they? Why is there a disconnect? Because that data, that body of data, is strongly militated against this. Now, notice the facts I used. They all have to do with Jesus or his followers.
Right.
And you say, well, yeah, but they took that data. They were inspired by Isis, who was the number one rival. She was a queen, the queen of Egypt, queen of heaven, she was called. That's the number one rival to Christianity. How do you know that the disciples didn't steal that, didn't say, yeah, we like that doctrine of Isis. We're going to tack it on to the life of Jesus. Well, first of all, Isis didn't rise from the dead.
Right.
There's no teaching like that. That religion is not about Osiris, her husband. It's about Isis. The main problems with this are twofold. They're on both sides. The one side is we're dealing with the disciples, and they said,
yeah,
I saw the risen Jesus.
Right.
And you say, well, isn't that kind of naive? A guy says he saw somebody, so you believe he saw him? I say, well, wait a minute. Would you give your life for something I don't require that I prove that they gave their lives. I just say they're willing to die for their faith, and nobody questions that. Would you be willing to die and put your whole future on something you know to be false? Well, people do it all the time. No, they don't.
Right.
People die for things that are not true, but people don't willingly die for things that they know not to be true.
Right.
People hold all kinds of things that are false. We have a presidential election coming up. There's any number of people who are going to say there's true things and false things here. But people don't work and work and work for something they know to be false. They certainly don't die for something they know to be false. Let's go to the other side of it. The material itself. There is not, we don't have any evidence for a single god or goddess before Christianity. We don't have a single document or whatever that shows that god or goddess was believed to have been raised from the dead before Jesus. The first times we see dying and rising gods, you always hear this phrase, dying and rising gods. Well, where does that come around? Didn't Christians copy that? Okay. Well, the earliest one is Adonis. Now, Adonis is pre-Christian, but the first account where Adonis is raised is 2nd century A.D., 2nd century A.D., or more than 100 years after Jesus. The next best case is Attis, A-T-T-I-S, Attis, that's 3rd century A.D. That's about 200 years after Jesus. Well, it could have been earlier. Now, see, now the skeptical shoe's on the other foot. And so I say to the skeptic, well, yeah, I guess they could have taught that earlier. But why don't you show me that so we know?
Right.
I mean, can you base your case on it could have been earlier? Or should you have the same burden that I do, which is show me the facts?
Right.
You know? So on the one hand, we don't have these guys rising from the dead. Not before Jesus, at least no source of that. And secondly, the five facts deal with the disciples, what they claimed, what they were willing to die for, what they showed they saw, these guys don't get on the page. You say, well, they're lying. Well, I don't think you die for a known
yeah.
lie.
Yeah.
So you kind of catch them coming and going. But the big problem right off the bat with that is that these teachings are not, you can't trace them back. In fact, a book came out just a few years ago where a scholar, unlike the 90% of popular critics take this theory, this scholar, he takes this view. He takes a view very similar to this. However, he admits he's about the only guy in the world that does it. And secondly, this is amazing, he says it's pre-Christian, but it doesn't help us explain the resurrection of Jesus.
Mm.
And he's about the only guy that takes this.
Right.
So he's pretty easy to deal with because he doesn't even take this to explain the resurrection. So there's no argument there. So
yeah.
these guys holler. They'll go, no, there's 20 of those guys who, then show me the data and show me that the data are pre-Christian.
Right.
In the discussion.
Right. Now, there's another theory. Well, actually, that answers a number of them. For instance, that the disciples stole a body. And
sure.
The point that you just made was then they would be dying for what they know was a lie.
You know, Harold, the last time a specialist in New Testament or theology or a critic, the stolen body has probably come up two or three times in 200 years.
Wow.
Almost no skeptic goes there. Why? Because they get cooked. You get them in a corner. I had a dialogue one time with a professor who was anti-Christian, but he was not a specialist. He just was angry about Christians. And I said, well, please, pick a theory. Tell me what you think happened. Now, in debates, a lot of Christians probably think, I hope he doesn't pick one, then I got to come up with something. No, you want them to pick theories.
Right.
You want them to say something, because right away the facts are going to come down. So this guy said, I don't know. Disciples stole the body. He did this obvious, he had this chip on his shoulder. Nah, disciples stole the body. So I start giving reasons. You can't explain their change of mind. You can't explain why they're willing to die for this. You can't explain that other people other than them also said they saw Jesus and so on. And finally, right in the middle of our talk, he gets upset with me. He had a pipe in his mouth and he got upset with me. And you know how it sounds when someone's biting down on a pipe. He says, Habermas, you're starting to get me in a corner and I don't like that. As far as I'm concerned, this dialogue's over. It was over. He wouldn't talk about it anymore.
What?
Just
wow.
Like that. So he picked it. He took that quickly, I mean 5 minutes, got himself in a corner, and he just said, I'm done talking. I don't like this feeling. I said, well, I'm not trying to put you in a corner, but,
Yeah, here's another one.
Sure.
Actually, I'm teaching a class on the 12 points of proof Christianity is true, mm-hmm. and I was talking about the resurrection, and someone brought this one up. It's the belief that the resurrection was sort of added a little bit later. If you look at the gospel, this is their point. This is their gospel. If you look at the gospels, they progress in theology. For instance, John is the latest gospel, and John has all the theology.
He's got two chapters in the resurrection.
Right.
Everyone else has one.
Right. So then, mm-hmm. So then that was something that John added, or maybe even, mm-hmm. someone added a little bit later on. It sort of progressed into this whole resurrection thing. It didn't start out that way.
It's thoughtful, isn't it? When you see one angel to the tomb in Matthew, one angel to the tomb in Mark, two in Luke, and two in John, you think there's some progression here. Let me just cut this one off real easily this way. One of the five facts is that the resurrection proclamation did not wait until Mark, did not wait till Matthew, Luke, and John, which is usually the author, lineup of the dates for the Gospels, according to scholars. Every scholar who deals with this believes that the proclamation of the resurrection did not start up there. It was way back 30 to 35 AD. They can trace that. I'll give you the argument if you want. But basically, they think, here's the latest scholars. I'll just give you their conclusion. Latest scholars. Gerrit Ludemann, an atheistic New Testament scholar, says that Paul received his message of the resurrection and talked to other disciples no more than 3 years after the cross. Don't forget, he saw Jesus even earlier, and the disciples saw it even earlier. But I mean, he actually came and met with them, Galatians 1, and with other Christians even earlier in Damascus, he says, just 3 years after the cross. The Jesus Seminar. If anybody knows the Jesus Seminar,
yeah.
they are have the reputation of being way out on the left side. They're the ones who reject 80 to 90% of all the words of Jesus. They say that Paul got this report, that the formalization of the report happened before Paul's conversion, which is about 2 years after the cross. James D.G. Dunn and Larry Hurtado, two of the most influential European scholars today, two of the major teachers, major universities in England and Scotland, they believe that this lecturing started in, that it came, it became formalized in 30 A.D. So it didn't take decades. They go, well, okay, but what about the one angel, the two angels? And what about John has two chapters, everybody else has one? What if I told you that the earliest account is not Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John? The earliest account is Paul in 1 Corinthians 15.
Right.
Everybody admits that. And Paul, the earliest one, has more appearances than anybody else. So our earliest one has the most appearances. Ah, well, that breaks down our bigger as we go on theory.
Right, right.
Also,
right.
They say that we theologize about things. The more time it goes on, more time goes on, we talk about things. Paul theologizes about the resurrection more than anybody else.
Yeah.
And it's right there from the beginning. So it doesn't work. If you can get it back to 30 AD, it's not something that started way down here.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay, well, thanks for being on the show, Dr.
Thank
Gary
you.
Habermas, talking about or answering objections to the resurrection.
Sorry.
And that will end this episode of Giving an Answer. Be sure to join me again next time. And until then, goodbye and God bless.